Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, for decades, women and girls have been primarily diagnosed with eating disorders. But lately, health providers are finding that men, and especially adolescent boys, are prone to eating disorders as well, though they may exhibit different symptoms than girls, including disordered eating driven by a desire to bulk up or put on muscle mass. This hour, we'll look at the challenges of diagnosing eating disorders in boys and why hospitalizations for boys with disordered eating are on the rise. Do you have a personal experience with an eating disorder? What helped you? Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A growing number of doctors and researchers are working to better identify and treat eating disorders in boys as more adolescents come to hospitals with disordered eating or struggling with the shape of their bodies. With eating disorders long believed to predominantly affect women and girls, diagnostic tools were focused on female bodies, but it's now estimated that about 1 in 3 with an eating disorder is male. Joining me now is one of the doctors working to better understand how eating disorders affect boys and what behaviors to be on the lookout for. Dr. Jason Nagata, a pediatrician at UC San Francisco and editor of the book Eating Disorders in Boys and Men. And listeners, if you or someone you know is struggling with an eating disorder and feel the need for support, you can find resources and helplines at nationaleatingdisorders.org/get-help. Welcome to Forum, Dr. Nagata.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really glad to have you. So tell us, how do eating disorders tend to show up in boys?
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, a vast majority of prior body image and eating disorder research has really focused on thinness and weight loss, particularly in females. And so we think about restricting food intake, fasting, vomiting, or even taking laxatives or diet pills to lose weight. And these are the typical questions that medical providers are trained to screen for. But I think there's been very little focus on eating disorders in boys and men who actually may have very different body image goals. For instance, the masculine body ideal has become increasingly large and muscular. And so that can lead to other dietary patterns like protein overconsumption while cutting carbs and fats. Athletes are also at high risk because they can present as excessive or even compulsive exercise and also have pressures to use performance-enhancing drugs like anabolic steroids.
So I've heard that an extreme desire to become large and muscular has been called muscle dysmorphia. I think I've also heard it as reverse anorexia. Can you just describe what someone with muscle dysmorphia might be thinking and doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the colloquial term, as you mentioned, for muscle dysmorphia is reverse anorexia because people with muscle dysmorphia think that their bodies are puny or tiny, even though they may objectively be big or bulky. So the reverse is the case in anorexia, where you might have somebody who objectively is thin, but they think that they're fat. And so this is sort of the reverse, where they may be actually large, but they when they look at themselves, they think, oh, I need to get bigger and bulkier. And this can lead to performance-enhancing drug use, like anabolic steroids or excessive exercise. And I will say that this is a relatively recent diagnosis. It was only introduced in the latest version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is sort of the Bible of mental health diagnoses. And so there is not that much research on it. It's only been around for the last 10 years.
And talk about why it has been so hard to diagnose, and also the traditional diagnostic tools and how they were geared toward female bodies.
Yeah, absolutely. Prior to 2016, 99% of the research was really on female samples. And so that really, I think, had downstream effects to the medical community because, as I mentioned, the assessment tools, the diagnosis and the treatment tools that are, researched are really very biased towards female samples. And so, they don't really capture these muscle-enhancing behaviors or goals.
I think I heard that one of the criteria were for diagnosing anorexia, for example, were missed menstrual periods.
Yeah, exactly. Prior to this most recent DSM, you had to lose periods to have a diagnosis of anorexia. And obviously, that doesn't apply to boys. And I will say that even to this day, there are other guidelines that still use amenorrhea, which is the medical concept for loss of periods, as treatment guidelines. So there's I think we've made advances, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
So you're a pediatrician by training, and I understand that you got interested in this field because of your experience with one of the first patients you had, who was a 16-year-old wrestler. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually was fortunate to train here at UCSF in San Francisco for medical school. And one of the very first patients that I ever cared for was a 16-year-old wrestler whose parents actually had brought him in because something wasn't quite right. And it turns out that he had for years been obsessed with his appearance. He was weighing himself 10 times a day. He would severely fast and restrict food intake in order to make certain weight cutoffs. But at the same time, while he was trying to lose weight to make weight cutoffs, he was really trying to get big and muscular. And so he had wrestling practice, 2 to 3 hours a day. But then on top of that, all of his free time was in the gym. So he would be in the gym like 7 hours, basically every time that he wasn't in school, he was in the gym. And it really became an obsession in a way that it took over his life. He couldn't eat with family or friends anymore because he perceived the food that parents were cooking was not high enough in protein. Even though he was eating protein, he was, not eating any other food groups. And so he actually did develop severe complications of malnutrition, or essentially starvation, when you're working out 7 hours a day and you're not getting in enough nutrition. So he actually had to be hospitalized when we first saw him because he had such severe medical complications like a lower heart rate, liver dysfunction. And I remember as a new medical student trying to read about the guidelines and in textbooks what we could do to help this patient, and there was nothing because at the time, this was before the DSM, all the data was on females, and so there was nothing about muscle enhancing behaviors or as we mentioned, this loss of periods was part of the treatment guidelines. And so I remember thinking that he, part of the reason why he had been struggling for so many years without a diagnosis and that his treatment, I think, course was more challenging was that there just wasn't great data to guide patient management.
And are there more severe long-term effects if these things afflict you at such a young age or your body at such a young age, maybe as a teenager or as an adolescent?
Yeah, absolutely. The most common age of onset for eating disorders and muscle dysmorphia is actually in the adolescent or teenage years. And this can have a really profound impact on your growth because, as you know, teenagers are going through puberty, they're going through growth spurts, and that's sort of the one window you have, for this growth period. And if during that time you're in a starvation state, you can have stunted growth and some of these complications medically that you won't be able to regain once you've ended puberty.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation, wondering if what you're hearing from Dr. Nagata is resonating with you. Maybe you or someone you know have or have had an eating disorder, especially a man or boy. Also curious why you think eating disorders among boys is on the rise. You can email forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels @KQED Forum. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. How were you able to eventually help him, Dr. Nagata? I know you hospitalized him, but then,
Yeah, so treatment for eating disorders is interdisciplinary because, as you know, it's very complex. There's the underlying issue is a mental health issue, and so you need mental health support through a therapist or other trained, licensed counselor. But these dietary and exercise changes can have significant physiologic impacts. And so you also need a medical provider, checking your labs and vital signs and making sure that these complications that could be related to malnutrition or weight changes aren't affecting your vital organs. And then finally, having a nutrition provider to help guide, a more healthy recovery towards, a sort of treatment goal weight and nutrition is required. So we were able to work with him through our interdisciplinary team at UCSF with a nutritionist specialized in eating disorders, our adolescent medicine team, who are all pediatricians, and a therapist who was trained in eating disorder support. And I will say that for minors, the first line therapy is actually family-based treatment because, minors are still living at home and sometimes depending on the severity of the eating disorder, an individual may not have the insight to know that even they may just not want to eat. And so you really have to have parental supervision.
And is it your research that found that compared to girls who are hospitalized, boys tend to have more severe medical complications when they're hospitalized?
Yes, exactly. We actually just published a paper based on UCSF data from the last 10 years that compared all of our boys who are hospitalized to girls who are hospitalized. And on average, we actually found that boys are hospitalized for longer, and they have greater heart rate abnormalities. They have higher rates of anemia, so like low blood counts. And I think part of the reason is that, boys are diagnosed later. It's not really on many people's radar. So like this one patient, they could be suffering for months or years before they get treatment. So by the time they see us, it may be more severe. And I will say that our treatment protocols are all based on female samples. And one example of this is that when we re-nourish patients with nutrition, the dietary re-nourishment that are used nationally are actually based on female samples. But we know that actually growing teenage boys have greater energy requirements than girls. And so that makes it so that it takes longer for them to get to their kind of goal calories.
Hmm. I want to go to caller Christopher in El Cerrito. Christopher, you're on.
Hey there. Yeah, so I grew up as a wrestler, competitive or to stay competitive, I cut a lot of weight. So I was often fasting, going to school with just a half a cup of Cheerios to get me through the day, but as well as putting on PVC suits and doing workouts in the sauna at night and being very aware of my calorie restriction and water restriction and just how that's kind of played into my adult life, having chronic back pain, sciatic pain, as well as severe arthritis throughout my spine. I'm just kind of curious with the strenuous workouts and the dietary restrictions, is that something that's now playing out at 37 years old?
Oh, Christopher, thanks for sharing your story. Are what Christopher is experiencing now connected to that, Dr. Nagata?
Yeah, I think it's different for every individual, but I think you're absolutely right that, wrestlers in particular are at high risk for eating disorders because in some ways, making these weight cutoffs and engaging in some of these extreme weight control behaviors is normalized because everyone has to do it, to make certain weight cutoffs. And like our patient, unfortunately, he was doing this so much so regularly that it really took over his life. And as, we had mentioned, I do think that especially in your teenage years when you have big weight fluctuations, and perhaps there are periods when you're not getting enough food intake, especially in the setting of competitive athletics, that can have long-term health consequences. So I'm really sorry to hear that happened to you.
We're talking with Dr. Jason Nagata about eating disorders among boys. There's been a rise, and we're dissecting what makes it difficult to diagnose, why that rise has happened, and why it has been a challenge to obtain treatment. And we're talking about the long-term impacts. Jason Nagata is an adolescent medicine specialist at UCSF, senior editor for the Journal of Eating Disorders, and editor of the medical textbook Eating Disorders in Boys and Men. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation. If you or someone you know have had an eating disorder, what helped you? Why do you think it's on the rise? Why do you think it's difficult often to treat boys with eating disorders? Share your comments at forum@kqed.org. That's our email address. At our phone number, 866-733-6786, or on our social channels at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. For decades, it was believed that eating disorders among men and boys were rare. But now, research is finding hospitalizations of boys with disordered eating has been on the rise for the last two decades, and we're now learning how to identify it as it can present differently for males than females. Dr. Jason Nagata is an adolescent medicine specialist at UCSF and editor of the medical textbook Eating Disorders in Boys and Men. And you, our listeners, can join the conversation with your questions about eating disorders among boys, why you think it's on the rise, experiences that you've had with it, ways that you were able to get help. Our social channels are at KQED Forum on Twitter or X, Instagram, our digital community on Discord. You can post at our email address, forum@kqed.org, or call us 866-733-6786. And Dr. Nagata, it is on the rise, right? These hospitalizations are reflecting more incidents of eating disorders among boys, not just that we're able to identify and diagnose it more.
I think it's a little bit of both. But yes, there was a recent study actually from Canada that was the most surprising that actually found that since 2002, there's been a 400% increase in hospitalizations in Canada in boys specifically. And that was the demographic that had the largest rise. I do think that eating disorders cause is complex and multifactorial. So there are genetic and biological factors, but there also are sociocultural factors. And I think that one of the biggest factors in the last decade that could have contributed to this rise is actually the advent of social media, because there's always been, to some extent, some traditional media like television, movies, magazines that have promoted a muscular body ideal for boys or thinness ideal for girls. But social media, I think, is unique because for the first time, any teenager can produce their own content. And so not only are you living in a read-only environment, but teenagers are actually feeling pressure now to produce content, to gain likes, to gain followers.
So essentially display themselves.
To display themselves and their own bodies on social media. And actually, the few studies that have looked at social media in boys specifically have found that boys are much more likely than girls to actually display their full bodies in selfies, not just their face. This extra pressure for muscularity. And boys who consume more social media, especially image-based social media, are more likely to engage in meal skipping, disordered eating, be dissatisfied with their muscles, and even use anabolic steroids.
Did the pandemic play a role in also the increase?
Yeah, unfortunately, the pandemic was really a perfect storm of social isolation, anxiety, disruption of normal activities for teenagers, and a rise in social media use. And so actually at UCSF, we experienced a doubling, and even at the peak of the pandemic, a tripling of hospitalizations for eating disorders, such that in our medical surgical unit, we would take over half the beds in the hospital with eating disorder patients. It was really an unprecedented rise. And I do think that it has luckily decreased since then, but it's still well above the pre-pandemic levels.
Well, I want to bring into the conversation Tim Tollefson, a professional ultra runner and director of Mammoth Trail Fest, who has experience with body dysmorphic disorder. Tim, really glad to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know you've been sharing your story more about having body dysmorphic disorder, and I'm wondering when you started to struggle with eating or with an eating disorder or realizing that something was not quite right related to your relationship with your body.
As Dr. Nagata mentioned, I think there were a lot of different variables that played into it, but it really began back in kind of middle school, high school, so those adolescent years when there was a lot of the just kind of general sense of trying to find community and a place of belonging and finding yourself, comparing yourself with others, and definitely the introduction of social media, I think, did amplify that kind of stuff where it was like always engaged in this sort of impression management of like trying to protect my external perception or reputation through these channels while still just trying to figure out who I was as a person.
And you grew up in Northern California, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, in Rocklin, a suburb of Sacramento.
And so I understand that things intensified for you in college. Can you talk about what happened in college?
So as an athlete, especially one in a sport that does have sort of this social stigma of aesthetic determining performance of distance running. It's similar to kind of what Dr. Nagata was saying with wrestling or gymnastics or dancing. There was this cultural narrative at the time that I was growing up that thin is fast. And so there was a lot of kind of unspoken and very overt discussions around trying to lose weight to be more competitive and fast. And I think that just kind of paired, unfortunately, really well at a time that I was vulnerable and kind of seeking kind of that social acceptance and finding my place in the world.
I understand that you believed your body was flawed. What did you see or feel when you looked at your body?
So there's sort of a mixture of different things. And I wouldn't try to speak to this. I'd let Dr. Nagata, but, you know, with body dysmorphic disorder, I think it's really kind of when you do see perceived flaws in yourself or things that you don't like that aren't true. And for me, there's a combination. There's definitely the perception that I was overweight and had weight to lose, but also there were issues with my hair and symmetry kind of throughout my body that I think like I could pick up on and I would fixate on for hours and hours a day to the point that it would mean I couldn't show up to classes or go to work. And it really started to become debilitating because, as Dr. Nagata had mentioned, it became all consuming where I was fixated on these perceived flaws that no one else saw, but I was afraid to go out in the world. I couldn't show up.
How were you able to perform at such a high level as a college athlete and even as an ultramarathoner while dealing with these thoughts, these experiences?
I think a lot of it is just kind of that, I guess as an endurance athlete, you do have an inherent level of grit, but there's a lot of, there is a lot of just like ignoring things and thinking that you can just push through it. And I would say that while externally I was able to perform, internally I was really suffering and I was afraid of failing. And I think the fear of failure and not being accepted really drove me to continue to perform, but at the cost of my own happiness, my health as an athlete, and ultimately, I think the ability to self-actualize. I don't think I got the most out of myself because I was constantly undermining my ability to adapt to the training that was being done because I wasn't fueling and taking care of my body properly.
Did you feel like you could talk to anyone about this, or did other people reach out to you because they noticed that something might not be quite right?
That was a very difficult thing. And I think, again, this could be a generational or a cultural thing, but for boys and men, it's sort of taboo to speak out and express that you're struggling. And so I definitely had that belief that I couldn't share or speak up or ask for help because it felt like it was a flaw, another flaw. And so, you know, a lot of people do just suffer in silence. And when I was an undergrad, there was a point that my anorexia got so bad that teammates and coaches did start commenting. And I found myself sort of in that, angry state of denial of just trying to lie my way out of things because it felt hurtful that they were accusing me of something that I knew was true. But thankfully they did express concern, but it wasn't until years later that I actually asked for actual help. And that took a lot of courage because it's just really difficult to admit that, you know, something isn't right. And especially, like I said, kind of the gender stereotypes that we have in our culture, it's not okay for boys or men to say that they need help.
We're talking with Tim Tollefson, a professional ultra runner and director of the Mammoth Trail Fest. And you, our listeners, are also with us. Let me go next to caller Julie in San Francisco. Julie, you're on.
Yes, thank you very much. This broadcast really speaks to me as a mother of a son who developed anorexia in high school and early college. And his case was severe enough that he had multiple hormonal abnormalities. And as I think about it and look back on his life, I believe it really started as a young boy. He had his father's body habitus was a little on the chubby side and was always bullied in elementary school for being overweight and chubby. He was always one of the, quote, fat ones, slow runners type of thing. And even his good friends, he'd be at a play date and a mother would call me to say, "Your son locked himself in the bathroom. I'm so sorry. My boys were teasing him about being so fat and slow." And he was a fairly good athlete, was actually in musical theater. So what he looked like obviously was central to his his mental health. And it really all piled up by the time he was in high school and into early college. But I do believe it started off with some of that bullying as a young boy with other kids calling him fat, and that's something he internalized.
Well, Julie, thank you for telling us about your son. I'm curious, Tim, if there were experiences in your childhood, bullying or otherwise, that you think contributed to your body dysmorphic disorder.
I definitely did experience a significant amount of bullying that began when I was in fifth grade. And similar to the caller, it really led into this overwhelming just kind of acknowledgement that aesthetic and the way I showed up in the world mattered. And I guess to a degree that, you know, thinness equaled acceptance. And so it definitely planted seeds of doubt early on that, like, if I don't show up or look a certain way, that my ability to basically be accepted into this community is going to be a threat. And so there was about a year that, like, the bullying just kind of led me into fixating on how do I change myself? How do I change my personality? How do I change my body so that I don't have to experience the, you know, the pain of being pushed around?
Dr. Nagata, we're hearing about life experiences like this. You were talking earlier about the role of social media. Can one also be genetically predisposed to an eating disorder?
Yes, there are many different complex etiologies of an eating disorder. And studies have shown that there are genetic linkages, specifically with anorexia nervosa, which has been the most studied. But I do think that it's, like many things, a combination of nature versus nurture. Some people may have a genetic predisposition to an eating disorder, and then coupled with bullying or, you know, image pressures from social media or traditional media or family or friend pressures or sports pressures, that can sort of tip someone over the edge to a disorder.
Let me go to caller Kiri in Mill Valley next. Kiri, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much. I've never done this before, so I'll try and be calm as I'm talking.
Welcome.
Thank you. My son is 24, and when he was young, he had very restrictive eating. He'd only eat pizza, couldn't have basil on it, and he also got kind of chunky. And he got into his early 20s, and he actually had some fat removed from his lower stomach because he was so concerned about it. Lately, he has a cousin who has OCD. For the last 3 months, the only thing that he has eaten is an extra large plain cheese West Brooklyn pizza. It has to be delivered to a certain place on our front porch. I carry it in. He has 2 Barg's root beer. The only thing he drinks is Barg's root beer, and he will go through a case of it every couple of days. He will watch a movie and eat popcorn and candy. He was recently taken to the hospital, and the sheriff actually took him. They put him in intensive care for a week because he was malnourished and dehydrated, and I saw his report. He doesn't know I saw it, and he doesn't know I'm calling. And he had extremely high, I think they were triglycerides. Then he was in the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks after that, in the mental part. He's back home, and he is eating exactly the same. Mm. West Brooklyn pizza, they all know me. Just wondering what this could be.
Kiri, thank you. Is this an eating disorder, Dr. Nagata?
I think that one thing I'd mention is, first of all, I'm so sorry that this has happened to your son, and I will say it's not an uncommon scenario. I think for all the reasons we described, eating disorders are not, well recognized in boys, and they can have, and men, and they can present in many different ways and ways that kind of break the stereotypes that we think about. Based off of your story, I can't say exactly for sure.
Absolutely.
So I definitely think the best, next recourse is to get individualized care and follow up with his providers. But I will say that this does have a flavor of, there is actually another new diagnosis that was recently introduced in 2013, is called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And the characterization of that is, if someone has very, very specific food needs, like what you're saying, we'll have some kids who will only eat very specific chicken nuggets and that's all they will eat. Or like the pizza that you're describing. And so there are also some people who have, for various reasons, whether it's OCD or food aversions or sensory or smell preferences, will only eat one very specific type of food. And then as you have heard, you know, when you're only eating one type of food group, even if you are getting some energy from that, that can lead to, you know, a lot of nutritional imbalances. And so we've had, unfortunately, patients who get even blind from like not getting enough vitamin A or stuff like that. So I do think that definitely getting care for him sounds like the, like you are already is the next best step.
Well, Kiri, thank you for sharing that. Is there anything I can hear probably that support that Kiri can seek out also as Kiri tries to help her son?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately there are, as you've probably experienced, there are not a lot of, there's already a shortage of eating disorder specialists, and there's even more a shortage of people who really are trained to help support boys and men. But I do think that going to a specialized treatment center that has, you know, that interdisciplinary team of a nutritionist, a medical provider, and a mental health provider is really the best and most evidence-based, you know, first step. And then in terms of parent support, you know, if you go to the National Eating Disorder Association or other groups, there are some, you know, support groups for parents, and they sometimes do offer webinars and stuff. So I do encourage you to go to those resources.
Well, this listener has sort of a related comment. This listener writes, I am a mom of two. My son is 12 years old. He doesn't have a traditional eating disorder, but he has ARFID, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. He drinks most of his nutrition, protein shakes, and powder vegetables mixed in smoothies, but he won't eat a fruit or a vegetable or eat what the rest of the family is eating for dinner. His disordered eating isn't a body image issue. This is according to this listener. You also mentioned earlier about the wrestler. This is reminding me a little bit that he stopped eating with family and eating with friends and so on. What are some of the signs that something could be moving into an eating disorder or body dysmorphia?
Yeah, I think some warning signs for parents and families is when a boy develops preoccupations or even obsessions with appearance, weight, food, or exercise in a way that really worsens their quality of life and starts to impair school or social functioning. So as you know, we mentioned some boys who will spend all their waking hours exercising to the point that they feel guilty if they're not doing that, or you know, they stop eating with families because they perceive the food to not be high enough in protein or to be too high in fats. And I just did want to mention that there is sort of a spectrum.
Yeah.
And, you know, across the nation, a third of teenage boys report that they're actively trying to gain weight and build muscle. It's very common, but not all of those third will have an eating disorder. And, you know, moderate physical activity and exercise in moderation is actually recommended and good for your health. But there is, unfortunately, a subset who will take it to the extreme, for whom it no longer, you know, provides pleasure, but actually is more of a chore. It becomes an obsession. And for those people where it really worsens their quality of life, I think that's when parents need to be on the lookout.
Well, this listener writes, I am a woman who has lived with an eating disorder all my life. I am 70 years old and began telling doctors I had a food phobia at 20 years old. To this day, eating and not eating distracts me from what I want to accomplish every day. I am isolated and cannot keep food in the house. Thank you for sharing that, listener. We are talking this hour about eating disorders and the rise that we're seeing among boys. It's been an issue predominantly for women and girls, but we are finding that boys and men are prone to eating disorders as well. And we're talking with Dr. Jason Nagata, who has been dedicated to trying to provide more information on how to diagnose and treat men and boys with eating disorders. He's editor of the medical textbook Eating Disorders in Boys and Men and senior editor for the Journal of Eating Disorders and adolescent medicine specialist at UCSF. Tim Tollefson is also with us, a professional ultra runner and director of Mammoth Trail Fest. And so are you, our listeners. We'll have more with them and with you after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When it comes to helping adolescent boys that are dealing with eating disorders or body dysmorphia, options are limited. But a growing body of doctors and researchers are working to fill in the gaps in this field of medicine. One of them is Dr. Jason Nagata, an adolescent medicine specialist at UC San Francisco. We're also joined by Tim Tollefson, a professional ultra runner and director of Mammoth Trail Fest. And you, our listeners, are joining us at 866-733-6786. By emailing forum at kqed.org or by posting on our social channels at KQED Forum. And I want to bring into the conversation now John Chu. John Chu was diagnosed with anorexia. He's the author of Louder Than Hunger, a book for kids in grade six and up about his experience, though told through a character named Jacob Edward Stacy. John Chu, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've so enjoyed all of the conversation that you've been having, and I'm learning so much here in my hotel room in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, well, tell us about your book, and especially the main character, Jacob Edward Stacy.
Oh, and I love that you're using his full name, because my full legal name is John Edward Schumacher. And so Jake and I have the same initials, and my author name is John Chu. So Louder Than Hunger, which just came out Tuesday of this week, and so I've been going around the country celebrating it, tells the story that's very much based on my own experiences with anorexia nervosa, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, and anxiety. And when we meet Jake in the eighth grade, he's struggling to find his place in the world. He's having a very, very hard time at school. Eighth grade is a miserable place for him. And he feels as though his only friends are his grandma, who loves the color red. And he often talks to a photograph of Emily Dickinson, and she feels like an imaginary friend to Jake. Jake has a very hard time connecting with people his own age. He often feels as though he's on the periphery of the room and he's always looking in. And as Jake is going through middle school, there is a voice with a capital V that is getting louder and louder and louder. And it's telling Jake that he's worthless and that he's weak and that he doesn't deserve food. And Jake tries to make himself smaller and smaller and smaller. So Louder Than Hunger is about how do you gain control of the inner saboteur that's telling you that you don't deserve to take up space in this world.
And is that what you experienced, how you experienced this as an sort of this internal voice?
Yeah. So the zero draft of Louder Than Hunger, which was about 150 pages, allowed me to tell the truth. And I had to write down my own story. And after I wrote that, I decided I did not want to write a memoir, that I wanted to be able to play with the timeline, that I didn't want to address all of the real people in my life. And I think in some ways it felt safer and maybe less vulnerable to be able to change some of the truth. But as what I've been telling students during visits, I've been meeting with a lot of sixth through eighth graders, is that every emotion that Jake expresses in the book, every feeling that he has, is based on how I felt when I was in middle school. And I've dedicated my life to connecting with kids through story. I was a third grade teacher, a fourth grade teacher, school librarian for 9 years. And now that this book is out in the world, and I've been talking about it for a while, I've realized that when I'm working with kids, I'm always looking for the little Jakes of the world and the little Johnny Shoes of the world. And what can I do now? What can I do to help them before maybe a loud voice awakens in their own minds?
You have talked about how books on eating disorders, some of them can be quite toxic for kids to read, even ones that maybe you were reading as you were trying to understand what you were going through, may not have necessarily been helpful. How did you approach writing this in a way that would be safe for kids to read?
Oh, I am so grateful you asked me that question, because when I'm 42 years old right now, and when I was 35, I started to work on perhaps a book like this, and I stopped because I remembered how I would go to the public library and I would read articles about people like Tracy Gold and Karen Carpenter. And I would read books that were so toxic. I would read books that really served as how-to manuals. And a few years ago, I wrote an adult study called The Gift of Story, and it's about the affective side of learning. And in that book, and I'm going to quote myself, which always sounds a little strange, I write this. I write that books can be the perfect prescriptions to let us know that we're going to be okay. And whenever I was working on Louder Than Hunger and every draft was written in a notebook, I always had that written on a post-it note. And if ever I was going in a direction where I felt like I was glorifying anorexia nervosa or I was teaching kids how to be sick, that did not belong in the book. And so that was always my guide. And I'm so grateful that in many of the reviews, they've pointed that out. The New York Times pointed out that, you know, in no way is John showing that anorexia is a good thing. Jake is miserable from the very, very first page.
We're talking with John Chu, author of a book about eating a boy with an eating disorder. It's called Louder Than Hunger. We're also talking with Tim Tollefson, a professional ultra runner and director of Mammoth Trail Fest. And we're talking with Dr. Jason Nagata, an adolescent medicine specialist at UCSF. And you, our listeners, are writing in. This listener writes, I'm a 66-year-old gay man and have seen a few waves of body fashion for men and boys. Lookism and ageism are rampant. Several young gay men I know have struggled with body dysmorphia, which is a manageable but incurable condition, as I understand it. Is there any data on the correlation between gender identity and eating disorders? Are gay, non-binary boys more prone to this than heterosexual boys? What special protocols are needed for care of this population? And Dr. Nagata, I'll turn to you for that.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing. And I think that while eating disorders in boys and men is an under-researched area, eating disorders in trans boys and men is even more under-researched. And I do think that with today's youth, we actually do see that almost the highest rates of eating disorders among trans youth. You could imagine that this is the case because if somebody has a sex assigned at birth that doesn't match with their gender identity, there's already an inherent mismatch. And so sometimes there's a lot of dissatisfaction for these young people of being in a body that they don't identify with. And so sort of at a very baseline, even without like the weight loss or the muscle building behaviors, if you're just in a body that doesn't feel like right for you, that can lead to a lot of body dissatisfaction. So I do think that, you know, our trans youth in particular have the highest rates of body dissatisfaction overall. And then there's also much more complexity that we also know that trans youth, especially across the country, have, you know, extreme bullying, severe discrimination. And so there's all these other factors that other callers and our other speakers have mentioned that really can lead to poorer self-esteem, more depression, and then can manifest as disordered eating. So I do think that trans youth in particular are at high risk of eating disorders. And as mentioned, you know, sexual orientation is a related but separate issue. And the studies have found that gay men in particular are at a 2 to 4 higher risk of eating disorders, even compared to heterosexual men. And there are, you know, we mentioned that social media is one, you know, potential societal influence. But, you know, the other big influences are basically peers and the media. And in general, we do, you know, studies have shown that the postings like social media influences, particularly of sexual minority men like gay and bisexual men, often are very image based. And that can add to these pressures to have an ideal body and then more dissatisfaction when one doesn't have an ideal body.
Lucia writes, as a pediatric physical therapist, one idea for addressing some forms of disordered eating, seek out help from an occupational therapist who specializes in sensory integration and in eating challenges. Also, speech and language therapists sometimes specialize in this. Tim, you talked about how you eventually decided to seek therapy, and you talked about how hard that was. I'm wondering how you did that. What prompted that? What was the switch for you that said, okay, I need to seek help and be open with this?
Ultimately, it was that I found myself so lonely and kind of retreating from society and relationships, my wife and others, that I didn't see a future. I had gone from someone that really did enjoy life to being scared that I didn't think I had a future, and recognizing that I really just needed someone to like guide me. And you know, you had asked earlier about how did you hold everything together or perform well, and one thing I've, you know, kind of like John mentioned, I'm 39 and I didn't start treatment until I was 35. So for almost 20 years, I just kind of, you know, was burying it and trying to grip my teeth through it. And what I've realized is that even though I started this process, like recovery is a habit and it's something I have to actively kind of, you know, challenge each and every day, because there are a lot of deep rooted things that, because they weren't addressed earlier, they just come back so instinctually, like that I'm habituated to these patterns and these behavioral traits. But yeah, it's once I did finally speak out, what was nice is that it kind of highlighted that, hey, I'm not alone in this. And that's, I think, what makes a lot of people fearful of asking for help, is you feel like you're the only person that's ever gone through something like this. And once you do use your voice, you recognize that other people have similar experiences, and it's comforting to know that you're not the only person.
John, I understand that you were hospitalized at one point. What helped you?
Yeah, so I actually spent almost 2 years in and out of residential treatment facilities. And I got to the point after 2 years that my psychiatrist and therapist and psychologist said, John, you've gone through, we've given you all of the advice that we can. We've done everything. We now have to turn it over to you. And at that point, I didn't think it would ever be possible to start talking back to the voice. But there was actually an experience that happened in a bookshop, a real bookshop called Unabridged Books in Chicago. And I remember entering that space and feeling unlike I ever had in a space before. Mm-hmm. It was magical. And I was on a day trip with my mom, and we walked around a neighborhood called Lakeview and Lincoln Park. And I remember thinking, I want to live here one day, and I want to be here. And I feel so alive here, and I haven't felt that way in a long time. And that was the beginning. Hmm. And then I discovered a little musical called Rent. And I think listening to Rent helped me feel less alone. And I discovered the voice of Idina Menzel. Hmm. And I started on the path of recovery because of bookstores and theater and eventually libraries and story.
Hmm. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. And let me go to caller Audrey next in San Mateo. Audrey, you're on.
Thanks. I've been listening for many years and first time ever calling. But I just wanted to share my experience and maybe get a comment. I'm obviously not, well, maybe not obviously, but I'm not male, but I do have two young men in their 20s. And I myself am in recovery from an eating disorder that I discovered I have had all my life. I had it in adolescence, kind of overcame it without therapy or anything. And it came roaring back during the pandemic, like many people have the experience of. And it's actually not one of the body related ones or body image ones. It's orthorexia. And I haven't heard that specifically mentioned here. I didn't catch the whole show. But I wondered if there are any comments about that. And then secondarily, I've noticed my older son has some mental health challenges, including OCD and ADHD. And I see in him now a lot of the tendencies that I can now identify as being mine, because I you know, suffered with this for in my early 60s. So all my life without really identifying what was going on. So I just wondered if there's some sort of familial connections, genetics or anything like that. And also if there is any advice for, you know, helping him out. We have a great relationship, and I'm able to talk to him very openly about all of this. So if there are any tips for kind of helping him, you know, navigate and not go down that path.
Audrey, thank you. Orthorexia, we touched a little bit on the genetic, potential genetic connections, and then also help Dr. Nagata.
Yeah, so thank you so much for highlighting this other new condition called orthorexia nervosa. As I mentioned, I think the presentations in boys and men are much more diverse than they are in girls and women. And so orthorexia is a recent diagnosis. It's not actually officially in the DSM, but it's sort of this obsession or preoccupation about healthiness or healthy eating. So it's not necessarily with the goal of weight loss or muscle gain. It's just like health in general, but it can lead to preoccupations, obsessions that can take over someone's thoughts and behaviors. And so I do think that this is a newer diagnosis that, you know, we don't have a lot of research on, but is also something that many men and actually women can present with. And I do think that for your sons and for young people who are potentially struggling with this, I do think that talking to your primary care provider is a good first step, because they can do some initial labs or assessments and then try to help you with referrals as needed.
Let me go next to caller Rachel in Oakland. Rachel, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My son is in recovery from an eating disorder, and he's also an athlete. I was wondering about the ethics of some of the training in adolescent athletes that the wrestler was talking about, and I was wondering if there are any sort of movements to push back to push back against the normalized extreme behaviors.
Rachel, thanks. You know, Tim, I'll go to you on this, just in terms of, you know, are things changing in sports with a recognition of how that world can, as it did for you, sort of amplify the eating disorder or the other issues?
So just speaking in relation to the running world or endurance sports, there definitely has been a shift over the last decade, I would say, with people being more outspoken that you really don't need to manipulate your body to meet the demands of sport, but through training and taking care of your body and nourishing it, you will start to adapt to the demands of that specific discipline. And so there is more of that narrative being shifted, but there's still a lot of kind of, I'd say, I don't know, below surface discussions that like we can latch on to the weight because that's low hanging fruit and we can manipulate weight very quickly. But it is something that, you know, you might get short term gains, but long term negative effects as a result of it.
Well, Urban writes, I'm a county medical health professional, but I haven't heard anything about overeating, binging or gorging, especially in young boys who've been exposed to severe childhood neglect or alternately undergoing extended attachment separation from parents, such as what happens when they've been placed in foster care. Dr. Nagata.
Yeah, thanks so much for raising awareness about binge eating as well. Actually, binge eating disorder is, of the formal diagnoses, is actually the most common eating disorder, and I think has been highlighted by some of the callers earlier. I think one stereotype or misinformation about eating disorders is that most people think that all people with eating disorders are thin. But in fact, people who have larger bodies or may have been teased for being fat or overweight actually have much higher rates of disorder eating than those who are, you know, quote unquote, normal weight or underweight. And so I do think that raising awareness that eating disorders can affect people of all body sizes, and especially those who experience a lot of weight stigma, who are like on the higher weight ends, is definitely underrecognized and is in also need of additional research and treatment.
Tim, we heard from John about how going to the bookstore, being exposed to certain things really helped put him on a path toward healing. I'm wondering, is there something that happened or something someone said or just something that really helped you that stands out to you?
You know, I think really what I recognized was that just the more I started to like open up and talk, the connection with people and sort of that shared vulnerability made me feel like that I belonged. Because I think like most kids, you really, we're in this world trying to find our place that we feel like we fit in. And, you know, as a result, we often are trying to conform and sort of like create this identity. But I think the best way to really find that authenticity of ourselves is through just being originally ourselves. Through the different types of therapies I've had, a lot of values-based work has helped a lot. And I have found that like going back to figuring out what I value and not values that were given to me has helped a lot.
Well, Tim Tolleson, thank you for talking to us and sharing your story. Same with you, John Chu. And Dr. Nagata, thank you for the work you are doing in this space. Thank you, listeners, for sharing your stories today as well. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.